VOA Wonder Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Jill Robbins and Alice Bryant. Alice also answers a question from an English learner in this week's Ask a Teacher. We close our show with an American story. This week, it is part 4 of The Blue Hotel. But first, here is Jill Robbins.
The U.S. Congress passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Within months of its approval, the law permitted hundreds of thousands of African Americans to register to vote. But as the law turns 56 this month, voting rights supporters say the legislation faces the most serious dangers yet to its existence. One threat is a set of restrictive voting rules passed by Republican-controlled states across the nation. The other is a conservative-controlled Supreme Court, which has steadily lessened the legal protections under the law. The Brennan Center for Justice reported that nearly 400 bills described as election reform have been introduced in 49 states this year. Of these bills, 30 have been signed into law in 18 states. The center said the laws will make it harder for Americans to vote. They include restrictions on mail voting and early voting. They also add stronger voter identification requirements and make it easier to remove certain voters. Democrats called the new laws a form of voter suppression. In Texas, Democratic lawmakers even left the state to prevent the Republican majority from holding a vote. U.S. President Joe Biden criticized the bills as an assault on hard-won voting rights. Speaking from Philadelphia in July, Biden said, "The 21st century Jim Crow assault is real." The term was about the 19th and 20th century racial segregation laws. It is now used to describe voter suppression moves. Republican officials behind the laws say they are meant to prevent fraud and bring back public confidence in elections. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp said of the state's new election law, "Georgia will take another step toward ensuring our elections are secure, accessible, and fair." The U.S. Constitution did not guarantee everyone the right to vote. Black men first gained the right to vote after the Civil War with the passage of the 15th Amendment in 1870. But some southern states still restricted the right to vote by requiring them to pay taxes or to pass a literacy test, setting off a long struggle for civil rights. An important marker in the movement came on March 7, 1965. On that day, a group of 600 activists, led by John Lewis, marched from Selma, Alabama, to the state's capital, Montgomery, to register black voters. They were violently attacked by police. Images of the incident, known as Bloody Sunday, were televised around the country. It caused a national outcry that brought support for voting rights legislation. Lewis, who suffered a skull fracture in the march, went on to become a member of Congress. It was worth the suffering of so many people. "It was worthy of the blood that some of us gave," Lewis said in a 2015 interview with VOA. On August 6, 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. It outlawed the literacy test that had made it almost impossible for many blacks to register to vote. More importantly, it included two measures known as Section 4 and Section 5, requiring states to get federal approval for any change in their voting laws and policies. Marc Morial, a former mayor of New Orleans, now heads the National Urban League. He told VOA that the two sections made democracy fair, level, and even-handed. Both Congress and the U.S. Supreme Court supported the law throughout the 1970s and 1980s. Then, in 2013, the Supreme Court weakened the law, voting 5-4 to cancel Section 4. The ruling effectively ended the requirement that states, mainly in the South, have to get federal approval for any change in their voting laws and policies. In the 50 years since the Voting Rights Act's passage, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that things have changed dramatically in the areas that are subject to the law, making the requirement unnecessary. Within hours of the ruling, the state of Texas announced that it would immediately require a photo identification to vote. That state law had been blocked under the Voting Rights Act. Soon, other states did the same thing. Earlier this year, the Supreme Court approved two Arizona voting rules that were not permitted under the Act. The first rule throws out votes entered in the wrong polling area. The second makes it a crime for anyone other than family members or caregivers to collect a voter's ballot. Democrats argued that both rules made voting more difficult for minority voters, in violation of Section 2. But the six conservative justices of the Supreme Court rejected the argument that the voting laws cause unnecessary problems for voters. Viewing the Supreme Court as hostile to voting rights, Democrats have introduced two bills in Congress to protect the gains of the Voting Rights Act. The John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act would once again require certain areas to get federal approval for changing their voting rules. Another legislation, known as the For the People Act, would create automatic voter registration across the country, restore voting rights to criminals who have completed their sentences, and expand early and mail voting, among other measures. Republican opposition makes it unlikely that the two proposals will pass this year. I'm Jill Robbins.
At just 4 years of age, Bridget Shea has already won a place to perform piano at New York City's Carnegie Hall. The young girl also can read music. She can even play a piece of classical music from Beethoven. It is called Sonatina in F Major. Bridget's feet hang above the floor when the small girl sits on the piano seat. Her hands move spiritedly across the piano keys. She shyly looked down when her mother, Nicole San, asked if she likes piano and if it is fun. "Yeah, fun," Bridget replied. The young girl wears her long brown hair tied back. Bridget's father, Dal Shea of Ridgefield, Connecticut, signed her up for online piano lessons on Zoom about a year ago. The video conferencing program became a popular way to attend all kinds of classes during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dao bought the lessons to give his daughter something to do after officials ordered people to stay at home. At the beginning, I never expected that she's going to be a prodigy or anything, he said. But he was happily surprised that it happened. Bridget is the youngest winner of the well-respected Elite International Music Competition. That win earned her the chance to perform at Carnegie Hall. In November 2020, she was supposed to play there as part of a competition called the American Protégé International Music Talent Competition. But it got delayed to this November and now to November 2022 because of the ongoing COVID-19 crisis. Bridget's mother gives credit to her piano teacher, Felicia Feng Zhang. Bridget came to me when she was just 2 months after 3 years old, her teacher said. From the lessons I observed, she has a curious mind and she loves to learn. We call that passion. She added that during the lessons, the girls' big eyes really, really watch me and how I demonstrate. She says Bridget's concentration level is really high and continues to improve, and she follows directions very well. Nicole Son says her daughter may have more skill and interest in music than other children, but the most important thing is that they found Felicia. Yeah, we are really lucky to have met her and have her as Bridget's first piano teacher, she said. I'm Alice Bryant. This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Joelson. He says, Dear VOA, I am an English learner from Brazil. I want to know the difference between remind and remember. Thank you very much. Hi, Joelson. That is an excellent question. Verb pairs like borrow, lend, come, go, and remind, remember can be tricky for English learners. The verbs remind and remember both involve recalling something. But there is a clear difference in meaning, and they have different sentence structures. Remember means to keep a person or thing in your mind or to bring a person or thing back to your mind. Think of remember as the opposite of forget. Listen to some examples.
I just remembered I left the water on.
Remember to bring a lock to store your belongings.
In the first example, notice that remember is followed by a clause. In the second, it is followed by an infinitive, also known as 2+ verb. Remember can also be followed by a noun that ends in ing, as in, I remember leaving the water on. Now let's talk about remind. Remind means to cause someone else to remember something. In other words, a person can make sure someone else does not forget something. Listen to an example.
Can you remind him to buy more cat food? We ran out.
When we use remind this way, the verb is followed by an object. In this case, the object is him. Another way we use remind is to say that a similarity causes us to think of someone or something. Listen to an example.
That actor reminds me so much of my brother. They have the same eyes and laugh.
When we use remind this way, we always include the word of. And that's Ask a Teacher for this week. I'm Alice Bryant.
The Blue Hotel, Part 4.
The Swede's face, fresh from Johnny's blows, felt more pleasure than pain in the wind and the whipping snow. A number of square shapes appeared before him, and he recognized them as the houses of the town. He traveled along a street until he found a saloon. He pushed open the door and entered. At the end of the room, four men sat drinking at a table. The Swede dropped his bag upon the floor and, smiling at the saloon keeper, said,
"Give me some whiskey. Will you?"
The man placed a bottle, a whiskey glass, and a glass of ice-filled water upon a table. The Swede poured himself an extra large amount of whiskey and drank it down.
"Bad night,"
remarked the saloon keeper without interest. He was acting as though he were not noticing the man, but it could have been seen that he was secretly studying the remains of blood on the Swede's face.
"Bad night,"
he said again.
"Oh, it's good enough for me,"
replied the Swede as he poured himself some more whiskey.
"No,"
continued the Swede,
"this isn't too bad weather. It's good enough for me."
The large drinks of whiskey made the Swede's eyes watery, and he breathed a little heavier.
"Well, I guess I'll take another drink,"
said the Swede after a while.
"Would you like something?"
"No, thanks. I'm not drinking. How did you hurt your face?"
The Swede immediately began to talk loudly.
"Oh, in a fight. I beat the soul out of a man at Scully's Hotel."
This caught the interest of the four men at the table.
"Who was it?"
asked one.
"Johnny Scully, son of the man who owns the hotel. He will be nearly dead for some weeks, I can tell you. I beat him well, I did. He couldn't get up. They had to carry him into the house. Have a drink."
Instantly, the men, in a quiet way, surrounded themselves in privacy.
"No, thanks,"
said one. It was a strange group. Two were well-known local businessmen. One was a lawyer, and one was a gambler. But a close look at the group would not have enabled an observer to pick the gambler from the other men. He was, in fact, so delicate in manner and so careful with whom he gambled that the men of the town completely trusted and admired him. His business was regarded with fear and lack of respect. That is why, without doubt, his quiet dignity shone brightly above the quiet dignity of men who might be merely hat makers or builders or salesmen. Beyond an occasional unwise traveler who came by rail, this gambler supposedly cheated only careless farmers who, when rich with good crops, drove into town full of foolish pride. Hearing at times of such a farmer, the important men of Romper usually laughed at his losses. And if they thought of the gambler at all, it was with a kind of pride of knowing he would never dare to attack their wisdom and courage. Besides, it was known that this gambler had a wife and two children in a nice little house, where he led a perfect home life. And when anyone even suggested that there was a fault in his character, the men immediately described the virtues of his family life. And one must not forget to declare the bare fact of his entire position in Romper. It is true that in all affairs other than his business, this card player was so generous, so fair, so good, that he could be considered to have a higher moral sense than 9/10 of the citizens of Romper. And so it happened that he was seated in this saloon with two local businessmen and the lawyer. The Swede continued to drink whiskey and to try to make the saloon keeper drink with him.
Come on. Have a drink. Come on. No? Well, have a little one then. By God, I've beaten a man tonight. And I beat him good, too. Gentlemen,
the Swede cried to the men at the table.
Have a drink?
Shh, quiet,
said the saloon keeper. The group at the table, although really interested, had been trying to appear busy and talk. But now a man lifted his eyes towards the Swede and said shortly,
Thanks. We don't want any more.
At this reply, the Swede straightened.
Well,
he shouted,
it seems I can't get anybody to drink with me. I want someone to drink with me now. Now! Do you understand?
He struck the table with his hand. Years of experience had hardened the saloon keeper. He merely answered,
I hear you.
Well,
cried the Swede,
listen then. See those men over there? Well, they're going to drink with me, and don't you forget it. Now you watch.
Stop that,
shouted the saloon keeper.
Why should I?
Demanded the Swede. He walked to the men's table and by chance laid his hand on the shoulder of the gambler.
What about it?
He asked angrily.
I asked you to drink with me.
The gambler simply turned his head and spoke over his shoulder.
My friend, I don't know you.
Never mind,
answered the Swede.
Come and have a drink.
Now, my boy,
advised the gambler kindly,
take your hand off my shoulder and go away.
He was a little, thin man, and it seemed strange to hear him use this tone to the big Swede. The other men at the table said nothing.
What? You won't drink with me, you little fool? I'll make you then. I'll make you.
The Swede had grasped the gambler fiercely at the throat and was dragging him from his chair. The other men jumped up. The saloon keeper ran toward the table. There was a great scene of shouts and movements, and then a long knife appeared in the hand of the gambler. It shot forward, and a human body was cut as easily as if it had been a piece of fruit. The Swede fell with a cry of greatest surprise. The businessman and the lawyer must have rushed out of the place backward. The saloon keeper found himself hanging weakly to the arm of a chair and gazing into the eyes of a murderer.
Henry,
said the latter,
you tell them where to find me. I'll be home waiting.
Then he left. A moment afterward, the saloon keeper was in the street, racing through the storm for help and, more important, companionship. Months later, the cowboy was cooking meat on the stove of a small cattle farm near the Dakota border when there was the sound of a horse stopping outside. The Easterner entered with mail and newspapers.
Well,
said the Easterner at once,
the fellow who killed the Swede will spend 3 years in prison. That's not much, is it?
He will? 3 years!
The cowboy turned the meat in the pan.
3 years. That isn't much. No,
replied the Easterner.
There was a lot of sympathy for him in Romper.
If the saloon keeper had been any good,
said the cowboy thoughtfully,
he would have gone in and hit that Swede on the head with a bottle in the beginning of it. That would have stopped all this murdering.
Yes, 1,000 things might have happened,
said the Easterner sharply. The cowboy moved his pan of meat on the fire, continued with his philosophy.
It's strange, isn't it? If he hadn't said Johnny was cheating, he'd be alive this minute. He was an awful fool. I believe he was crazy.
I feel sorry for that gambler,
said the Easterner.
So do I,
said the cowboy.
He doesn't deserve 3 years in prison for killing that fellow.
The Swede might not have been killed if everything had been honest.
Might not have been killed,
exclaimed the cowboy.
Everything honest? When he said that Johnny was cheating and acted so crazy, and then in the saloon he practically asked to get hurt?
With these arguments, the cowboy made the Easterner angry.
You're a fool,
cried the Easterner fiercely.
You're a bigger fool than that Swede. Now let me tell you one thing. Let me tell you one thing. Listen. Johnny was cheating. Johnny,
said the cowboy blankly. There was a minute of silence, and then he said strongly,
oh, no. The game was only for fun.
Fun or not,
said the Easterner.
Johnny was cheating. I saw him. I know it. I saw him. And I refused to stand up and be a man. I let the Swede fight alone, and you were simply jumping around the place and wanting to fight. And old Scully, too. We are all in it. This poor gambler just got pulled into it. Every sin is the result of shared effort. We, 5 of us, have shared in the murder of this Swede. You, I, Johnny, old Scully, and that fool of an unfortunate gambler came merely at the end of a human movement and gets all the punishment.
The cowboy, hurt and angry, cried out blindly into this mystery of thought.
Well, I didn't do anything, did I?
That's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.